Hello and welcome to Whom Pods Destroy. I'm Terry DeFedden. If you're a first-time listener, then welcome. This is a Star Trek discussion podcast that focuses on the original series. In this edition, we'll be discussing the second season episode, Return to Tomorrow, an episode which is probably most famous for that "risk is our business" speech, and is also notable for the first appearance of the actress Diana Muldaur, who will be no stranger to fans of The Next Generation. Plus, of course, some wonderful acting by Leonard Nimoy when the body of Spock is inhabited by the evil Henoch. This is a story about the pleasures of flesh and the power of love and the despair of isolation, and we think it's a cracker. If you enjoy the show, and indeed enjoy this podcast in general, then please subscribe to the feed and give us a 5-star rating. Go to whompodsdestroy.com for all the details. If you feel we've missed anything, then drop us a line at garth@whompodsdestroy.com or hit us up on Twitter at whompodsdestroy. We'll be very happy to read out any feedback on a future episode.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
They used to say if man could fly, he'd have wings. But he did fly. He discovered he had to. Do you wish that the first Apollo mission hadn't reached the moon, or that we hadn't gone on to Mars and then to the nearest star? That's like saying you wish that you still operated with scalpels and sewed your patients up with catgut, like your great-great-great-great-grandfather used to. I'm in command. I could order this. But I'm not. Because Dr. McCoy is right in pointing out the enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibilities, the potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great. Risk. Risk is our business. That's what this starship is all about. That's why we're aboard her.
Hello and welcome to Whom Pods Destroy. My name is Terry DeFedden and I'm joined, as always, by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And by Derek Mantle.
Hello.
Jolly good. Right, well, let's dive straight into it, gents. No opening banter, no discovery chat, nothing like that. No, you didn't want to talk? No, we don't want to talk.
Oh, I think we should. I think we should go straight in there. Yes. Just like the episode we're going to discuss.
Just like the episode that we're going to discuss, which is Return to Tomorrow.
Yes.
Second season episode of the original series. Another hidden classic. This one is actually, I think, actually could be a hidden gem. Because I was having a look on the kind of, you know, top 10, top 20 Star Trek episodes, TOS episodes.
Yeah.
And this doesn't really appear in too many of them. And yet, when you read reviews of it, it's always reviewed very, very favourably. It always gets very positive reviews.
Mm.
And yet, for some reason, is not one that people...
Yeah.
Is that because it's an episode which is like a set episode, where they're sort of like, you know, they've either got them down in the actual cavern or actually on the Enterprise. There's not much sort of special.
It's just a slightly opened bottle episode.
It is. Yeah. Yes, it is a slightly opened bottle episode.
It's not caught. It's not a caught episode.
For listeners who don't know, the Return to Tomorrow is the one with Sargon and Thalesa and Henoch, who are these creatures who have evolved into pure energy, and they live in, what would you describe them? Spheres.
Mm. Pink balls.
Pink balls.
Yes.
Yeah, balls.
Balls.
They live in large balls. And they've been living there for millions of years or thousands of years. And they encounter or they call out to the Enterprise. The Enterprise come along and they ask if it's possible to borrow the bodies of Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, and Dr. Anne Mulhall in order to build android bodies so that they can transfer their consciousness into the android bodies and then go about their business. And they've got like loads of technology, loads of knowledge. They've been around for ages. And the trade-off is that the Federation will learn all of their wonderful technological secrets and will be advanced further. However, these beings are not as advanced as they say they are, and they're quite keen on the bodies in which they live.
There's a lot of probing in this.
Your probes have touched me, Mr. Spock.
There is a bit of probing going on. It's that kind of episode. That kind of episode. There's a lot of love in this episode, and there's a lot of sexuality going on there, isn't there? Henock is the guy who tries to actually ruin everything, and he's thwarted by Sargon, who turns out to be the good egg. My first observation of many of this episode was that I was reminded of What Are Little Girls Made Of, actually.
Yeah.
In the whole idea of transferring consciousness into an android body.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, we weren't going to talk about Discovery, but there's a degree of transference of personnel into personality into something else, into another person going on in Discovery. But they go about it in an incredibly ham-fisted, long story arc-y kind of way. whereas in the original series of Star Trek, it's just a bright light, and then William Shatner going, ooh, and then suddenly he's
and
someone
doing
else.
The robot.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure if you take that sequence and put it with a bit of electronic music, you could actually do a really good little GIF or whatever it is.
I'm sure there's one knocking about. I'm sure there is.
Swear Trek would probably come up.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a startling sequence.
What did you think of that sequence? I mean, so we're talking about when Kirk, Spock, and Dr. Anne Mulhall transferred down Sargon's. We don't know the name of the planet. Do we ever find out the name of the planet?
Ah, you do actually. I mean, I don't know if it's actually in the screenplay, but it's called Arret.
Is it?
Yeah, and do you know what Arret spelt backwards is? Terra.
Terror. Mm-hmm. Right, well, you see, the thing is, I was going to leave this question until the last, but I guess I might as well bring it forward now. The upshot of it is that these guys, they are basically, they refer to Kirk and the humans there as my children, and indeed the Vulcans as well. And there is this kind of assumption that they are progenitors, perhaps, or potential progenitors.
Well, this is what Sargon suggests.
Yeah, and Spock suggests that this might actually be the case.
Yeah.
Whereas Mulhall suggests that this is not the case.
Yeah, but they go on about them, Sargon leaving his seed all over the universe.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really yucky.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, I mean, that's the concept explored also in the Paradise Syndrome, mm-hmm. an otherwise ghastly episode, but has the preservers in them, which has actually resonated beyond there. So
TNG cover it.
They
well,
did a
think,
big.
Didn't
they did a
the
big,
chase.
The chase. Yeah,
which is a really, really good episode of TNG. And it turns out that there's this old ancient race who sowed the seeds for the Klingons, Romulans, Cardassians, and humans, and others as well.
And so they're all related.
And says, well, you're all related here. And that's proper Star Trek, that episode is as well. And it's nice, it's a good pace to it, that episode. It's a good, because it is a chase. And so there's a race against time going on. That's really good. So yeah, these are not old concepts. Ultimately, I mean, we are skipping to the end, but let's bring it in now because it doesn't matter. The reasons why Thalesa and, Henock and to a lesser extent Thalesa want to keep the bodies that they borrowed is because ultimately they are human. And I suppose the part is the advance that they've got, they're still driven by human desires.
Jiggy, jiggy.
Of physicality.
Mm.
Yeah, and the desire to be jiggy, which you just can't be. You know, in an android body, or at least not in these android bodies.
No, but interestingly, this episode comes immediately in production order. It comes immediately after By Any Other Name, which has a lot of similar themes of aliens assuming human form or taking human form.
Yes.
And then falling foul of human fallibilities, jealousy, and emotions, and things like that. So it is. Whether or not they had these feelings when they went into the bodies or before they went into the bodies isn't really explained, or whether or not it's just the interaction of their psyche and the human bodies that they occupy that make them do what they eventually do.
Yeah, indeed. And it's interesting because obviously Sargon is above all of this, because although he's deeply in love with his wife, Thalesa, he knows that this is not the way forward, but has managed to cut himself off from those kind of, or manage those kind of jiggy feelings to the extent where he's prepared to, one, go into an android body, and then when it becomes apparent that that's not an option.
I mean, when it starts off, it sort of starts off, before the title sequence. you come along and it's like an omnipotent sort of like sort of godlike contact with the people who, you know, after the probes. Sargon seems to be quite threatening right at the beginning, because the first thing he says is that I'm, you know, it is like a threat, isn't it? It's like I'm here to save you. Mm. You know, and it's like, are you actually the things that are going to cause our problems?
That's when that's in the cold open of the show.
That's really to make it more of a hook.
Yeah,
it's
a hook
for the audience
to
say, oh, we've encountered some wrongs here.
But then, when after the title sequence, and we're into the first act, you have the case of where Spock, McCoy, and Kirk, you know, were discussing about going down to this, you know, down to the planet. And the thing is, like, the Kirk says to Spock, you're going to stay here because we need to, you know, make sure that we have at least one senior officer here. And obviously Sargon shows his displeasure by turning off all the power.
Shuts the
which
ship
I thought that was a bit malevolent, you know. sort of.
Should have rung a few alarm bells.
Yeah. You know, it didn't fit in to later on.
Needing to insert moments of sort of like false drama, really, or false peril.
Yeah.
In order to move the story forward.
Which is what it does.
Which is what it does. But I mean, looking back on it and rewatching it numerous times, that does seem a little too false.
Mm.
Watching it for the first and possibly the only time, you know,
you're
by the time you got to the end.
Yeah, because it does move the story on quickly.
So. Yeah.
But it needs to, because it does cover a lot of elements. And if anything, it almost covers too many elements for the length of the episode. I find that the ending does come about a bit quick.
Yes.
The whole sort of the moment when,
but that's usual with Star Trek,
it is a bit, you have to try and get everything done quite quickly.
A lot of really good ideas, and then they sort of have to tie
it all up in a bow.
This was heavily rewritten as well, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was. It was originally, the story was written, it was originally by a guy called John Kingsbridge.
But he
had his name removed and replaced with his pen name of John T. Duggan, because it was rewritten by Gene Roddenberry. John T. Duggan was apparently quite a well-established writer, but was also a devout Catholic. And in the end, what happens is that he wrote it that Thalesa and Sargon would move to a higher plane of existence
and be together.
So they were and would be together, as you know, still as beings. But and Roddenberry, being a humanist, said that actually they're going to die. But it's interesting because in the script, it's sort of like the idea of, you know, eternity together sort of left things open.
It's ambiguous.
But Duggan was clearly felt that was too ambiguous, and that in fact, you know, that's not what happens to you when you die. You live on, and then, you know, if you're married and in love, then you stay together in heaven or in the hereafter. Whereas Roddenberry didn't buy any of that. He was
I think the key word was oblivion.
And the oblivion,
that's the word, because that's
oblivion together is what.
Oblivion together. Does
not frighten me, beloved.
Promise we'll be together.
I promise, beloved.
Together forever.
Forever. Beloved. Forever.
Kind of, well, you know, we're going to die, but there is nothing here.
We're jumping off this cliff together.
Let's do it together. And of course, it also making an act of suicide. And Duggan was deeply upset by this and felt that this was not what he wanted to do. I wanted to taunt, and that's why he had his pen name instead. Which do you think would have worked better, or do you not think you think it would have worked either way?
I don't know why they needed to do that, because they had at least one robot there to occupy, and obviously they just didn't want to do it, did they? It was
My impression from the story was that they clearly felt that what Henoch had done by betraying them, trying to kill them, being prepared to kill the crew, was that, you know, this was just an ill-conceived idea for everybody.
Yeah.
And that Thalesa had fallen for it and realised that... And presumably, it's just, when it comes down to it, it just wasn't something that they wanted to do.
Mm.
They didn't want to live in android bodies. They didn't have cloning, of course.
they'd had cloning, they could have cloned their own bodies, couldn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah,
I mean, we're stepping outside the bounds of the story.
Yeah, so. We are. I mean, obviously, the point of the story
I'm
is
like that guy. Aren't I?
You are standing like that guy.
Resheath your head cannon.
Yeah. You'll start saying, "Why did they say it was a Class M planet? It didn't have any atmosphere."
Yeah. That's the thing that got me.
I've listened to a lot of that over the last couple of weeks since Discovery finished, and I am sick of it. So yeah, no apologies. Scrap that. In fact, you know what? I may just cut that bit out.
Yeah.
Good. You choose wisely.
Yeah. So the idea of living in these robot bodies. The Henoch says, you know, we're imprisoning ourselves in these bodies.
A 1,000-year prison, Thalesa. And when it wears out, we'll build another one. And we'll lock ourselves into it for another 1,000 years. And then another. And another.
And yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just no way to live, is it?
It's quite interesting because the idea that obviously these eternal beings of energy and mind, you know, who did have bodies at one time, obviously forgot what it was like to be in a body, get back in a body and think, whoa, this is really great, you know, and it's actually better than what we were in. And I mean, is that the sort of message in the story as well? It's like to be human is actually a great thing to be, or to be a corporal.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it speaks to body. The primacy of human life and how great it is to be a human being, which is seriously a robbery thing.
I suppose in the Star Trek term, they do come to discuss this idea again later in TNG and more so in Deep Space Nine. With the parasite organisms Dax, which goes from are a higher alien consciousness transferred from a
shared consciousness
from a humanoid from one humanoid to another.
That's shared consciousness, isn't it? So that's Dax and Jadzia or Ezri and whoever else, you know, being two separate individuals joining. Although obviously it's symbiotic, but whereas in this episode, this is like we're going to take this guy's brain and stick it in a jar, and then we're going to put this guy's brain and put it in this guy's head.
And look after it as best we can.
There's a lot that we're sort of missing out about Kirk with his speech about how he does the big thing about discovery and risk and all this sort of stuff.
Risk is our business.
And the idea that sort of like...
Sorry.
That might be cut out as well.
That's why we're out here.
It is really that if anyone wants to do a William Shatner Kirk impression, you just watch this episode. Because this is... I think the one thing about Return to Tomorrow is that it is... If you're only ever going to watch one episode of the original series,
watch this one
because this has got everything you need in it, really. If you want to just ignore all the other ones, fine. Just watch this one. This will be fun. It's everything you need to know. That doesn't make it the best one.
No,
but it ticks a heck of a lot of check boxes.
Yeah, it does.
It's written by Gene Roddenberry, and the story is by Duggan, but the script is written by Gene Roddenberry. I mean, it would have been massively rewritten, obviously, because it was always being rewritten. These shows were always being rewritten, but it has the humanity, the primacy of human life, the idea that you know evolution doesn't always necessarily mean a better life, and all of the virtues of Star Trek are in this episode, and also it is a relatively non-violent. Non-confrontational episode. It's got all the good stuff in there.
Yeah, you get the feeling with that speech coming up quite near the end of the second series. This is Roddenberry's pitch saying, "Please give us a third series, please, and please keep me involved with it." when the second series was commissioned, the network said 26 episodes, budget for 26. But we've got an option to only take 16, which messed with their finances and everything and their planning of like trying to get episodes written and directors hired and actors. And this falls into that last 10 episodes, which were pretty much done on the hoof, and but just really in a sort of half-planned sort of way. And I think it works out well, but there are problems with the episode. And the fact that it does allow for all of the main actors to have a really good throw at their roles. I mean, Spock is brilliant.
Shall we talk about some of the actors then, shall we? Let's start with Leonard, because he's brilliant in this. Leonard is, as we know, is
evil
a
Spock.
Actor,
evil Spock.
Well, it's evil and smug at the same time.
Yeah, I think he's better in this than he is in Mirror Mirror.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, well, he's ultimately different, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, because he clearly relishes his
He looks evilness. Like a wise guy. You know, there's a bit where he's actually leaning up against at the doorway, and he's like, you know, with his arms crossed, and like, I'm fucking good.
Yeah. And also you can see he's clearly a very sexually, or at least wants to be a very sexually active man, because the first thing that he does is he clocks Christine and mentally undresses her.
Yeah.
Hello. Oh, you are a lovely female. A pleasant sight to wake up to after half a million years.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Cashing in on this backstory with Christine.
Yeah,
And obviously, being a woman of the 60s, written by men, the expectation is, because Miss Marjorie's like rubbing the back of her neck while she's being complimented by her. Thank you. When in fact, actually, it's seriously creepy.
And
a little bit, Yeah, it's all So we're looking at everything through a 2018 filter, and like almost everything seems massively creepy these days. But he just is great, and the scene with her and with him and Christine when he's explaining how he's going to kill Sargon, and obviously using his mental powers to get Christine to go along with all of this and manipulate her again. Creepy, but he's the bad guy, so
he's allowed to do creepy.
He's allowed to do creepy and unpleasant things. But and Nimoy is clearly relishing unshackling himself and being able to emote within the role of Spock.
Yeah, he does a bloody good job. He's a great actor.
Yeah, he is, isn't he?
Yeah,
I know this sounds a silly thing to say, but he really is a great actor. Was a great actor.
Well, you can see his range when you realise just how confined he was by playing Spock.
Yeah.
Which he does really well, of course.
He does.
But when you see him break out of that, and you think, oh yeah, that's him, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the guy from Mission Impossible, isn't
That's right. He does such a good job in suppressing Spock's emotions.
And still conveying them.
And conveying it. And you can see it. I mean, you've got to be a really good actor to do that. And he clearly took the role incredibly seriously. But really, it is in episodes like this when you realise why people say that this really is Leonard's show and not really Bill Shatner's show. And then you can understand why there might have been some, unpleasantness between Shatner and Nimoy, because Shatner would have seen this show and gone, I'm supposed to be the star of the show, but this guy's clearly the more interesting character.
Yeah.
Shatner does have his big chunk in there,
I thought he handled the Sargon transference things pretty well. I mean, it's going to be hammy.
But that's where we love it.
And it doesn't work very well. And he's really, really good at that. I mean, he's proper old school Shakespearean actor and really knows how to lay it down.
Yeah, and of course, you just ordered just an extra serving of scenery, please.
I mean, the speech, the risk is our business speech, is actually something that goes beyond the confines of the show. And it's a very, very famous Shatner speech. But it's interesting, I have, as you know, I've attended Star Trek conventions in Las Vegas, and every time Bill Shatner goes on to do his thing in the convention, they play this
really
beforehand. with 100%, isn't it funny actually, because I mean, like, it is, I think it could be a bit of a cultural thing here going on, because it's they love it, they think it's just brilliant, and this is Shatner's Kirk in an absolute nutshell. And I've always found it to be rather cheesy.
Yep,
It's only short. It's only just short. You're almost expecting to finish up with "Too boldly go where no man has gone before," don't you?
Absolutely.
And for everyone in the cinema to stand up and cheer. It's that moment, isn't it?
it's also not helped by the fact that it's accompanied by some very flowery scoring by the composer, George Dooning, who I'll mention very briefly. George Dooning is had done a number of episodes of Jack. This is an original score, so relatively, you know, uncommon. It's lovely. It is a lovely score. But George Dooning was very different to Fred Steiner and Sol Kaplan and Alexander Courage in that he used a lot more strings than those guys. Those guys used a lot more horns and a lot more percussion because the orchestras were so small that they weren't confident enough to be able to use that many strings. They didn't have that much in the way of strings. Whereas George Dooning didn't do that. So actually, if you listen to Dooning's scores by comparison to, say, Steiner's, or Gerald Fried's, they're more stringy, and they're a little bit more flowery,
a bit more traditional as well,
and a bit more traditional.
Because you see, when I was listening to it and actually watching the thing, when I first started watching, it started to go into the melodrama. You know, that's that. You know, after the first transference of the male and the female Sargon and Elissa into the bodies, and it was like into the soft focus, but there wasn't actually much soft focus in this
one. No, we're going to talk about Anne Mulholt in a moment. So
it became, to that point, I was going, oh, am I going to like this? Because it's now the music with this and that. And I thought, it's turning into a real long love story, melodrama.
Yeah.
I might actually hate this. And I didn't.
You didn't? No. It's a well-crafted
story. It's very well-crafted.
Let's just talk briefly about that story then, because yes, it is also because it is a love story.
Yeah.
It's a love story between Sargon and Henoch. Perhaps to a degree it's a love story between Spock and Christine. Maybe
there is that, because
it is a bit, but I think the problem with it is that if this had been a TNG episode, it would have been brilliant. Or if this had been a Voyager episode, it would have been brilliant. Because you've got regular female characters in there who have a regular input into the story arc. All right, yes, we've got Uhura there, but she doesn't have a regular input.
If it had been Picard and Beverly.
Yeah.
If Return to Tomorrow had been a TNG episode, it would have been Picard and Beverly.
Yeah.
And it would have been crackled.
Yeah, it would have really fizzled and popped, wouldn't it? Yeah, it would have done. But instead, what we have is we've got Diane Muldoon comes in, but because she's not a regular character, you don't have that same level of investment as to the relationships that she has there, or the fact that her body's having with Kirk. Or that. Yeah. So it's weird, isn't it?
It might have been interesting if they'd actually... I mean, Shatner would never have allowed it.
Yeah.
But if they'd actually gone, we'll put Sargon into Spock's... I mean, it would have changed, because obviously... And then Spock and Christine could have...
Slash fiction again, isn't
it? Well, no, bump up. No, I know what you mean. Well, that would have been amazing.
No, yeah, no surprise.
I would have loved that if that had happened. In Discovery, that's the kind of thing that would happen. Yeah. Definitely happen in Discovery. And good. Yeah. We want to see more of that. But yeah, what I was going to say is if Spock and Christine had... If they bumped up Christine and given her a bigger role.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they didn't. They went... They wanted to give... Pardon us... Henoch's the bad guy, so in order to serve the story, they give the bad guy the most powerful body with the freaky mind powers.
Yeah,
which I mean, Sargon is not necessarily to know that Henoch is a bad guy, but Henoch was his adversary in the war, because there's the background to this. There was this tremendous war between this society, and there's only three of them left. They're all of them are dead. So these are just the final three people. So that helped, I think, to convey that sense of loneliness and isolation that the characters had as well, actually. And that they were antisocial. You know, they've been living in...
So you're saying that when they're on their shells, they're bickering for thousands of years?
No, in fact, I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying what it is that it's possible that the old animosities, perhaps in Sargon's view, have died away. But obviously, in fact, they haven't. And what happens is Henoch takes Spock's body, and Henoch uses Spock's telepathic powers, perhaps to their fullest extent, or maybe he's enhanced them. And this has been great for the story, because it means we then have a powerful villain that we can, work with. But I mean, you could argue, why would they do something like that? But I mean, They did it because it's fun to watch.
Fun to watch, yeah. It makes good telly.
It makes really good telly. It'll be boring otherwise. Diana Meldora comes in as a guest star. This is the first time that we see her in Star Trek, but it is not the last.
No, certainly not.
By any means. Diana Meldora is...
I love the way she was introduced as well. Because They walk into the transporter room and she's just standing there with the red shirts and she's wearing a red tunic, which, if you want to put the voice on again, why was she wearing a red tunic when she's actually in the sciences? She's actually wearing engineering here, why is she?
But it's a great misdeception, isn't it? Good. It's good. What's the word that I'm looking for?
Misdirection.
Good misdirection.
Yeah, it is.
Because by this point it's mid-second season and we're used to red shirts but waiting for the captain in the transporter room.
Yeah.
And they usually were a yeoman and two security guards.
Yeah. Right?
And then you think, oh, okay, there's a yeoman and two security guards.
Yeah.
And in fact, no. That yeoman is not a yeoman. She's a doctor.
Yeah.
And she pipes up and interrupts them as well while they're talking.
Yeah.
Which, again, is a very, very nice touch. Mm. She goes...
They are it.
And then he's funny, Kirk looks around and goes, who are you? It's like, mate, you are the captain of this ship. I know there's 400 of them, but you probably should know who these people are. What do you do in your downtime? Yeah.
5-year mission.
Yab signed off my last three reviews.
I was on here before you were.
I'll get on to HR about that.
So Dr. Anne Mulhall is the Thalassa vessel, and Diana Muldoon turns up in another episode in the next series of Star Trek, the original series, and of course she is in the second season of TNG as Dr. Pulaski.
Now, I was trying to rack my brain because obviously Major Barrett's in this episode as well. She has quite a big role in this one. And I think Major Barrett, apart from being the voice of the computer, appeared in one episode of season 2 of TNG. Was she Manhunt?
I don't
know. Which, of course, season 2 was the season that Diane Muldoon was the ship's doctor.
Yes.
That's the one episode that they are both in there. So they are they're both in the same episode, in one episode of TOS and one episode of TNG.
We can look this up, but perhaps TNG listeners, listeners who are more TNG than TOS will be able to help us out with that one.
I don't think they have any significant screen time together.
No, I'm not conscious of that. Yeah. I say that. It hadn't occurred to me until you just mentioned it, so I don't know. it'd be something to think about and look at. But yeah. Yeah, of course, because my Jill Barrett played Luxana Troy, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Diane Muldoon, Broadway actress, and also an actress of the big screen as well.
Yeah, she came into this episode. She'd previously been on a stint on a daytime soap. So what you were saying about it being a bit melodramatic, sort of perhaps fits in with her casting there as well, and the way she approached the role. I think she handles this role better than Dr. Dana in When No Man's Gone Before, which covers a lot of similar ground, where you've got people becoming, there were people godlike. Godlike,
yeah.
The dangers of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I think she handles it quite well, actually.
Yeah. The character... Certainly, but the character is supplanted, whereas Dr. Dana is still Dr. Dana, she's awesome powers.
But her character is also, as you said, she interrupted Kirk at the beginning, but she's also got that spunk where she wants to, part of her little, after Kirk's speech about the, sort of risky business thing, and, she pumps up and says that she's going to go for it as well.
She wants to go for it,
as being a scientist.
Yeah, she's very brave, she's very independent, and she's not soft-focused.
No, she isn't.
Which is really interesting, because almost all of the others are.
Yeah, whether they need it or not.
Whether they need it or not.
She didn't need it. Those eyes, lovely.
Beautiful.
I also noticed something about, it's actually her accent reminded me of... Gillian Anderson, for some reason. She seemed to be quite similar.
Maybe she's from the same part of America, I don't know.
So there was an inflection in the way she spoke and something that was very similar.
Hmm.
Then again, I've been watching The X-Files recently, so...
I hadn't got that, but that's your in cadence, do you mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So just talking quickly about the... energy receptacles, the transference of the personality, of the spirit, the essence, into these balls. I'm thinking, well, I have to say, when I think when I first saw this episode, it was probably it was after I'd seen Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. I'm pretty certain it would have been. I don't think I remember seeing it when I was tiny. I think I watched it when in the 1980s when they were doing that run of them during, sort of to coincide with Star Trek III. And my first thought, I think, was the Catra, and thought it was a similar concept to the Catra in which, you know, all Vulcans have their essence stored. And I've always, because I've always wondered what on earth, you know, how that works. There's plenty of original fiction in which they speculate as to how
And you're
it works.
Asking us?
I'm asking you to speculate as to whether or not, you know, do you think perhaps the writers might have gone back to this idea and thought, okay, this seems like something we can use, you know, an idea of transferring personality into something else for a time
being. Sure they did.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Or indeed into another
thing. Exactly, I'm sure we've already mentioned about what a little girl's made of, the fact that that your consciousness can be removed and supplanted into something else is a concept that Star Trek is quite happy with. And of course it reaches its most important point in those films, doesn't it?
Yeah, and well, it's because he's got that wonderful sort of like moment with McCoy and Spock, who have been adversaries, you know, friendly adversaries for so many years, and they have their own recollection because they're essentially sharing the same consciousness.
Yeah, and the fact that Spock is leaking out a lot which is played brilliantly by DeForest Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, it is DeForest Kelly's finest hour, I think, is Star Trek III. But then you also have with Christine and Spock sharing consciousness in order to defeat Henock at the end, which is also I thought was quite a nice touch because it was a rare nod to the fact that there are previous episodes of this, because this show is still very much an anthology series and they don't worry too much about what happened before. But the fact that there was
but I think as well because of the line that Kirk gives right at the beginning, after he shared consciousness, when he said that when they were passing, they were one for a moment.
Right, but
they were, that gives the element the viewer has already got an idea of what's going on there, and so you can see that they are actually some shared a bit more special than just you close your eyes and now you're someone else.
But that's the thing. I mean, this bit with, because we find out that Nurse Chapel actually hosts Spock's essence to basically get past that well-known brand of hair shampoo, Henock. You know, and share one person's body, as you said, it's very much reused again in Search for Spock. But I was always wondering, because you don't have any inkling. It's actually very well done. You don't really have any inkling that this has actually happened with Spock and Kirk. Spock and Chapel. But as you were saying, the thing is that the two consciousnesses passing each other and sharing a moment. And obviously, you know, Nurse Chapel always wanted to share a moment with Kirk. Yeah, this is the first time that she had Spock inside her.
Really
do.
Oh,
really.
You got there in the end.
I did. Yeah, it took a long time.
I might trim that down.
I think
it sound a bit funny.
Yeah, yeah.
put a laughter track on that one.
I haven't got much more to ask you about these guys, so I will be asking you very shortly if there's anything that you think that I've missed. I was just going to ask about. No, you go on.
Talk a bit about the robot.
The
robot that they build. They
use bioneural technology in this year.
Because it's just
Shadows of Voyager
sticking around. What was happening with this robot afterwards? There's a story there, isn't there?
There is a story there, isn't there?
What does he say? Well, just chuck it out into space. No.
We should try and make this a bit of a regular feature on it on this show to try and think. Well, you know what good sequels spin out of this. How far do they get with that robot?
Do you know what? What happened to it? They did the old Indiana Jones thing. They put it in a crate. back in San Francisco, and then old Noonienson opened up the crate.
Hang on,
I can be sensitive.
Because I mean, you won't know. You might know this, but Noonienson's progenitors kick off the whole Android thing as far back as Enterprise, full season Enterprise. Brent Spiner makes a guest as, I think it's, is it, have you seen that episode?
I have seen two. I think it was a three-parter, actually.
Yeah, it's a three-parter one.
I saw two of them.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But I know, but I did get the gist of it. Yeah, because he's...
Yeah, so maybe they did. Maybe they packed it off to this guy soon and said, here you go, mate.
But the extra, or the stuntman, I think, who actually wears all the latex...
Does a great bit of acting.
You see him in... the closing credits of a couple of episodes.
Where he's standing, where he's sitting upright, yeah.
Well, there's one, I think, in the Immunity Syndrome where you see him standing up and he's clothed. And there's another one at the end of By Any Other Name where he's actually tearing off the latex.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can see him actually like pulling it off there and like you can see his normal skin underneath. Ooh. And the one where he's just sat up and he's got his white eyes and he's just rolling them up in the top of his head. So it's so keep your eye out for that.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I read a bit about that. There's a blooper reel.
Yes, which, yes, there is.
You know, you probably know more about it than I do. Where we've, because he's been put all this latex on it.
Yeah, and the director's saying like, you wanted to be in showbiz or something like that.
Yeah, suck it up, boy.
Yeah. I just wanted to. I wanted to say very briefly just about the friendship between Kirk and Spock, which I think moves on a little bit in this one because Spock dies, albeit temporarily. Mm.
So does Kirk.
And yeah, so does Kirk, but I'm thinking more in terms of Kirk's reaction to Spock's death. Mm. Is that sincere or do you think he's going, does he believe he's actually dead at this point, do you think?
I don't know. Carries it off as well as Shatner can,
yeah,
I suppose.
He does,
but
yeah.
Yeah, there's so much things going on there with people inside people's heads,
yeah.
And I think this is a whole what I think about the pacing of the end because it is a bit too quick. And
it does
you don't get time to ponder on things, do you?
Yeah, and really? I like the idea of Sargon living in the Enterprise computer as well for a while. That was quite cool. I mean, I do like these things as concepts, although they're obviously shortcuts to get to the end of the show. And if you think too carefully about them, then you'll end up affecting a Nick somewhat nerdy voice. Yeah. So it's best not to. But that bridge sequence actually at the end is really, really good. When they cut to Uhura screaming because Hanok is laying down some mind shit.
And Sulu's there for a short period of time. Because he'd been out for a while, hadn't he?
Yeah,
that's right. He was off. Was that the one he was doing Green Berets? Or was
Yes, he was. So he missed, I think, about 10 episodes, I think. So
10 episodes?
Yeah, it was a big chunk that he wasn't around for.
Remaster versus original, anything to say about that?
There's not really a lot there, really.
There's a nice beauty shops of the episode of the Enterprise. But yeah, not much else.
No.
I don't think. No.
No. No.
Okay. So not much more. Is there anything that, any closing remarks?
There is a little bit, actually. There is when McCoy's in the purple flames.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's changed slightly.
That's slightly changed. They made the flames, less like gas burners, basically.
Yeah.
Not by much, but I think that's the only thing that they've changed. And it's quite rare because they don't usually change effects with the characters on screen. They usually leave those the way they are.
Right. That's when Thalesa is losing her rag, isn't it? And, almost being convinced by a Hinnock.
Yeah, almost becoming.
Yeah.
In contrast to what we are, you are a prancing, savage medicine man. You dare defy one you should be on your knees worshipping? Destroy you with a single thought.
Yeah,
yeah. It is interesting how the gender roles. The gender roles are sort of like projected into the far future. Is it like they're still female, still male? It's like it's still got these drives and these episodes have dated in so many ways. But I think that it, as a adventure and as a love story, it works really, really well. And I do actually think that although the plot's a touch thin and at times that shows in the pacing, but actually it paces itself quite nicely. Yeah. I don't think it's not, given that there's not a lot of action and adventure going on there's not a tremendous amount of peril, but there's this kind of creeping peril and Hinnock is sort of like around doing his machinations, and the audience are aware of it, and while everyone else. And I like McCoy in this episode as well.
He works really well.
It's a bit uncharacteristic when he pulls out his phaser because it's like, well, you know, that's not really something that you do. But, you know, I mean, he has a lot to do in this episode, and I think he does it really well. So I think it's one of his better showings. Mm. Anything else? No. All right, then. We'll leave it there until next time. So thanks very much indeed for listening. And thank you, Graham. And thank you, Derek, for joining us.
No, thank you. Cheers.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
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 That's it for another edition of Whom Pods Destroy. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. I hope you enjoyed that discussion on Return to Tomorrow and will join us again for another episode. There are plenty of older episodes to listen to, so if you're stuck in the office and want to hear more Top Trek chat, then head over to whompodsdestroy.com. Our website also has contact details and feeds for Apple Podcasts and other podcatchers for you to subscribe. The topic of our next podcast is an episode with many similarities to Return to Tomorrow, an emoting Spock and another appearance by Diana Muldaur, also the same director and the same composer. So join us next time as we ask, is there in truth no beauty? There's some nice beauty shots of the Enterprise.
Yeah, yeah.
And they show the Rondo... Oh, no, that's the next episode.